Hello, I'm Greg Michelson, and I want to talk about Menshevizing idealism, or why the Soviet Union didn't develop the first computers. Let's start with some context. In 1946, the first modern digital computers were announced. These were the ENIAC in the USA at the University of Pennsylvania, which had been in active if secret use for war work, and the ACE at the UK in the National Physical Laboratory, which was still being designed. By 1948, many early US and UK computers were running, and there were commercial computers by 1951. In contrast, the first comparable Soviet computer wasn't running until 1951. This was the MESM, designed by Sergei Lebedev. So why was that? The USSR had theoretical and technical capability in control theory, in analog computing, and in sequence control systems, and computers were the key to economic planning and automation. Besides, digital computers weren't secret. There's been a long history of mechanical computation. So, mechanical calculators started around 1642 with Blaise Pascal's adder. Then in 1694, Leibniz built a multiplier. In 1822, Charles Babbage in the UK built difference engines that could generate tables. There were also analog computers that could carry out computations on continuous values. So during World War I, the great powers all had naval fire control systems in their battleships. In 1928, Vannevar Bush in the USA built differential analyzers, and in 1936, Lukyanov in the USSR built a water integrator. These were both intended for working with differential equations. There were also proto-digital computers. I'll explain about proto in a minute. In 1936, Zeus in Germany built the Z1, which he patented in 1937. In 1939, Berry and Atanasoff in the USA built the ABC. And in 1944, in the USA at Harvard, they built the automatic sequence control calculator, also known as the Mark 1. And there were also secret proto-digital computers. So in the UK, at Bletchley Park in 1943, there was Colossus, which was used to crack the German Lorenz cipher. It wasn't made public until the 1980s because the techniques were relevant to analysing string data. So, in 1945, John von Neumann published his report on the EDVAC, and this described stored program design, which is the key to digital computers, and it was very widely distributed. All subsequent general-purpose digital computers are stored program. So why didn't the USSR pick up on this? Anecdotally, Lebedev read about digital computers in 1948 in foreign popular magazines. And why didn't the USSR prioritise acquiring American and British designs? After all, they put a lot of energy into procuring atomic weapon details in the 1940s. So to explore this in more detail, let's start by thinking about what's special about computers. So computers are machines that execute instructions to transform data, and a program is a sequence of instructions. In a computer, there are two components. There's the central processing unit, also called the CPU, that carries out instructions, and there's the memory that holds the data. And here we'll include peripherals, like the mouse and the keyboard and the screen and the network. So there are instructions to move data from the memory to the CPU and to change the data in the CPU using arithmetic and comparison and to move data from the CPU back to the memory. Now normally instructions are carried out in a linear sequence, but there are also instructions to change the sequence depending on properties of the data. So a program can choose between optional sequences or it can repeat a sequence until some property is satisfied. Now in a proto-digital computer, the instruction sequences are fixed. They had to be physically changed for each program. So in the ENIAC, the functional components were wired together. And in the Colossus, instructions were set on switches and jack panels. Modern digital computers store the instructions in the memory along with the data. That makes it easy to change what the computer does, and a computer can also modify its own programs. Stored programs are usually attributed to John von Neumann, and he modified the ENIAC to use them in 1946 and 47. But von Neumann actually got the idea from Alan Turing, who'd written about this 10 years earlier in 1936-37. Turing was working on mathematical logic. That's the theoretical foundations of mathematics, and it was concerned with computability, that is, finding the limits to mechanical rule following. And this was well before digital computers. So let's now survey mathematical logic before considering its implications for philosophy. The earliest logical system is after Aristotle, 384 to 322 BC, and we call it propositional calculus. It deals with the values, true and false, and it has variables over values, x, y, and z. And there are operators of conjunction, logical and, so x and y is true only if both x and y are true. There's disjunction, logical or, x or y is true if either x or y or both are true. There's negation, logical not, so not x is true if x is false. And there's implication, x implies y, also written as if x then y. So we can write expressions built up using truth values and variables and operators, and then we'd like to know whether an expression is a theorem, that is, it's true for all the values of its variables. And we explore this using axioms, which are basic true expressions, and rules of inference, or syllogisms, and these connect premises to conclusions, usually using forms of implication. Then a proof establishes something as a theorem by starting with axioms and theorems as premises and applying the rules of inference until the required expression is the conclusion. And this is also known as deductive logic. Now, there are two important things to notice here. First of all, this is a pure calculus. It doesn't matter what the variables represent, they can only be true or false. And secondly, it's a form of logic that Hegel, Marx, and Engels were familiar with. The next development wasn't for nearly 2,000 years, when Auguste de Morgan in the UK, he lived between 1806 and 1871, developed the predicate calculus. This extends propositional calculus with predicates over truth values. These are properties that may be true or false. And there are quantifiers, so universal quantification talks about something being true for all variables, and existential quantification talks about something being true for some variables, and there are more axioms and rules of inference. But note that this is still a pure calculus, and it still doesn't matter what the predicates represent. The third development was set theory by Cantor, who lived in Germany from 1845 to 1918. He said that a set is a collection of things called elements, and these can be either symbols or other sets. So sets can include themselves. There are operators, like member, testing whether something's a member of a set, union, to join two sets without duplicates, intersection, to find the common elements of two sets, and to find the difference between two sets. Now, we can apply propositional and predicate calculus to set theory, where the predicates are properties of sets, and then we can quantify over sets, and we can fairly straightforwardly make a model of arithmetic. But there are two problems. The first is the problem of whether infinite sets are in some sense countable. Cantor thought they were, Engels was unhappy with this, and he mocked Cantor's ideas in Anti-Dering. There's also the problem of the paradoxes, for example, Russell's. Russell worried about the set of all sets that aren't members of themselves. So the problem is this set a member of itself or not? This drove wider interest in whether or not logic could capture all of mathematics. So from 1910 to 1927, Russell at Whitehead at Cambridge worked on Principia Mathematica. This is now seen as a heroic failure. Nonetheless, their contemporary David Hilbert, who lived from 1862 to 1943 in Germany, formulated what's now known as his program. He wanted to prove for mathematics three properties. First of all, mathematics should be consistent. so it should not be possible to prove contradictions. Secondly, mathematics should be complete. There shouldn't be any unprovable theorems. And thirdly, mathematics should be decidable. There should be a systematic way of establishing whether or not an expression is a theorem. Alas, it was not to be. First of all, Kurt Gödel, the Austrian-American mathematician who lived from 1906 to 1978, proved in 1931 that mathematics can't be both consistent and complete. And then Alan Turing, who lived from 1912 to 1954 and worked at Cambridge, showed in 1936 that mathematics can't be decidable. That is, there is no mechanical way to tell whether or not an expression is a theorem. And they both use proofs by contradiction, which we'll come back to in a minute. Now, Turing's approach was distinctive. Most logical models of mathematics require an implicit human being to do the proofs. But Turing invented a class of machines based on how humans do mathematics. So his machines have got a tape for the data. It holds a sequence of symbols, and they're controlled by rules that say, in the current state, depending on the current symbol on the tape, you can change the symbol, you can move the tape one symbol to the left or the right, and you can change the state. Now, it's important to reiterate that this is a machine. There is no implicit human being doing the proofs. And Turing showed that any mathematical expression can be represented on the tape. He also showed that Turing machines themselves can be represented on the tape. And finally, that you can make a universal Turing machine that will execute Turing machines represented on tapes. And this is where von Neumann's stored program came from. So what about the ontological status of logic? Well, there are three basic positions. There's logicism, or logical atomism, for example Bertrand Russell's position, that mathematics really is reducible to logic, and that's because the truth is out there. This is Platonic realism, and so it's idealism. The second approach is formalism, which is the approach David Hilbert took, where mathematics is just purely seen as applying rules to symbols. It's a language game. There are no necessary meanings. Now, in direct contrast to this, there's intuitionism developed by Brouwer in the Netherlands. Brouwer would only accept mathematical entities that can be constructed from first principles, so he had no time for infinities, and he also rejected proof by contradiction. And eventually, this led to the Soviet school of constructivism, in particular the work of Markov Jr. So let's now look at how this all played out with Marxist philosophy. Mathematical logic was seen as contrary to dialectical materialism. It was seen as mechanical materialism and as formalism. And the roots are in Engels' writings on logic and mathematics. For Marx and Engels, dialectical materialism was logic plus dialectics. Pure dialectics on its own was Hegelian idealism, and pure logic on its own was mechanical materialism. Engels wrote in 1878 in Anti-Döring that the philosophy of nature is empirical and abstracted from reality, and that dialectics goes beyond the narrow horizon of formal logic. Then in 1883, in the Mathematics Notes to the Dialectics of Nature, he wrote that formal logic enumerates, that is, it lists, the forms of motion of thoughts, whereas dialectics derives higher forms from lower forms. He said that formal logic isn't nonsense, but pure mathematics is abstractions, which becomes nonsense at the extremes. And then in 1886, in Ludwig Feuerbach and the End of Classical German Philosophy, he wrote that all that's left of philosophy, once it's been expelled from nature and history, is the theory of the laws of thought, that is logic and dialectics. Now, in the Soviet Union, after the October Revolution, there was a struggle over the philosophy of science. In the 1920s, the mechanist tendency gained ascendancy. They downplayed dialectics and they were reductionist. The champion of dialectical materialism was Abraham de Borin, and he said it was a synthesis of Hegelian dialectic and Feuerbachian materialism, and he was an anti-reductionist. So by 1929, the mechanists had been discredited as revisionist, and there was a purge of the Academy of Sciences, But then in 1930, with the new turn, Mitulin accused Deborin of formalism in his approach to dialectics, and he said that Deborin's dialectical materialism was not relevant to the practical needs of building socialism. Indeed, Stalin coined the term Menshevizing idealism for Deborin. By 1931, mechanism and Menshevizing idealism had been conflated with political orientation. So mechanism was associated with the right deviation with Bukharin, and Menshevizing idealism was associated with the left deviation with Trotsky. But this made career progression for mathematicians very, very difficult, and it led to a Soviet focus on applicable mathematics. And as I've said, subsequent Soviet mathematical logic was based on intuitionism and constructivism. This also had major international implications, particularly in the UK, where the Communist Party had leading scientists as members. In 1931, the Second International Congress of History of Science and Technology was held in London, and there was a paper by the Soviet philosopher Hessen on the current Soviet line. At the meeting was David Guest. He lived between 1911 and 1938. He was a mathematician at Cambridge and at Southampton, and he was killed in Spain fighting for the International Brigades. He supported Hessen at the Congress. In 1934, he wrote a short paper called Machian Tendency in Modern British Philosophy, and he followed the orthodox Soviet position. He attacked logicists and formalists, and he promoted intuitionism as revolutionary. In 1934, a collection of papers appeared called Aspects of Dialectical Materialism, with two by communist scientists. First of all, there was Hyman Levy, who lived from 1889 to 1975. He was a mathematician at Imperial College and a friend of David Guest. And he said that the dialectics add nothing to science, and he was subsequently criticised as a mechanist. Then there was J.D. Bernal, who lived from 1901 to 1971, and he was an X-ray crystallographer at Cambridge and Birkbeck. And he said in a rather more nuanced way that dialectic is not applicable to experimental science. Then there was J.B.S. Haldane, who lived from 1892 to 1964, and he was a geneticist and a physiologist at University College London. And in 1938, he wrote Marxist Philosophy in the Sciences. He again took an orthodox Soviet position. He reiterated Engels' disquiet with infinite sets. He said that Marxists should be sceptical of more ambitious logical theories, because logical systems only work in highly abstract contexts. He certainly knew about calculating machines, the differential analysers, and he said that he thought they might herald a new epoch in mathematics. Finally, there was Maurice Cornforth, the logician and philosopher, who lived from 1909 to 1980. In 1946, he wrote a book called Science versus Idealism. Again, this reiterated the orthodox Soviet critique of pure empiricism, but he brought it up to date by dealing with modern logic, particularly Wittgenstein. And it was written as a tribute to David Guest and helped by Haldane. So we can see these British communists all knew each other, but further, they had close contact with the USSR, and they had strong links particularly to the currents in logic and mathematics, especially at Cambridge. But none of them seem to have noticed Turing's papers. So in conclusion, I think this was a real lost opportunity for the USSR. And it was compounded by the 1940s Soviet critique of cybernetics. For example, in 1950, Boris Agapov, the editor of Literary Gazette, said that the capitalists wanted to replace class-conscious workers and soldiers with compliant robots. He also said that computers are no use for planning. Nonetheless, Soviet military and scientists really wanted computers, and there were two secret design programs. At the Academy of Sciences in the Ukraine, they built the MESM. And then at the Ministry of Machine Building and Instrument Construction, they built a machine called the Strela. Things became a lot easier in the Khrushchev period after the 1953 thaw. And in the mid-1960s, the USSR could build world-class computers. like the BESM-6. The West was worried by this progress, and there's a CIA report that suggested that the USSR might soon overtake the West. But the problem was that there were just too many competing projects. There were different organisations in the ministries, in academia, in the military. There was no standardisation of hardware and software, so there was loads of replication, and programming tended to be done at the lowest levels. And they couldn't ramp up to meet the growing demand. So in the late 1960s, they made what I think was a tragic mistake, and they abandoned their own designs to make clones of IBM 360 computers. And they never ever caught up. They always lagged behind the Americans. So, what about Alan Turing? Well, he was neither ideological nor political, so there's maybe an irony that his approach was materialist in Engels's terms, because he worked from observation to theory to practice. Now, Turing's results certainly constrain computation, and therefore they constrain the reach of logic. But Turing also argued in an early 1950s paper that thought is computational. So we might conclude that dialectics is a component of thought, so dialectics must also be constrained by computation. So I reckon it would be worth exploring the implications of all this for dialectical materialism, in particular the relationships between computation, logic and dialectics. So, thank you for listening. If you'd like to read more about this, I strongly recommend Helena Sheehan's Marxism and the Philosophy of Science, A Critical History, Humanities Press 1985-1993, and republished by Verso Books in 2017. And you might also like a book I co-authored with Paul Cockshott and Lewis McKenzie called Computation and Its Limits, put out by Oxford University Press in 2012. Thank you.